From Montana to Alabama, New Jersey to Nevada, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, artificial intelligence is the new frontier in technology, but will government regulators slow its growth? Neil Chilson of the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University is here to explore. House Republicans have launched an impeachment inquiry against President Joe Biden. Serious charges or political payback? Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Calls are getting louder for more tariffs on imported steel, but Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports on the real cost to consumers of protectionist policies. And on his American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA remembers the evil that visited America on September 11th, 2001. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Two U.S. senators are proposing broad new federal regulatory powers over the development and deployment of artificial intelligence. To examine the impact, we turn to Neil Chilson. He is Senior Research Fellow at the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. Neil, welcome to American Radio Journal. Neil, for those who are not sure what the term artificial intelligence means, what do we mean by the term artificial intelligence?
Well, artificial intelligence is a very vague term in computer science. It tends to mean when you have a computer or some sort of computational device act in ways that we would characterize as humans acting. And so it covers everything from being able to recognize visually shapes, such as identifying letters or numbers, to being able to generate pictures or text in a way that humans, when reading it, might think that it might have come from another human. So it's a very functional definition in most places, but it's a very vague term. And so often people lump it together with many things that we might just call software.
So as with any type of technology, I would assume here, Neil, that there are obviously some very positive uses for it, but also some red flags, some dangers it could be ahead.
Like any tool, AI can be used well and it can be used badly, just like regular intelligence. In fact, we can use human intelligence well or we can use it very badly. And we have plenty of examples of both. And so I think that we should look to the potential of the tool and not regulate in a way that stops the good if we're trying to address some of the concerns with the bad.
There's some discussion about regulation, Neil, and sort of a blueprint, a framework has been put out by Senators Richard Blumenthal and Josh Hawley, and you've referred to it as techno-panic. Tell us what the senators are proposing and why there are problems with it.
The framework proposed by Senators Blumenthal and Hawley is very skeletal at this point. It calls for licensing and auditing of AI companies in a way that would be a total transformation of the U.S. software industry, which has been the world leader in tech innovation. A regime in which you had to ask the government permission to create new software would be totally different than the very successful industries that we've had in the past around this. And so I have a bunch of concerns. While it's a very vague and skeletal proposal, what the concrete ideas that it does contain are very concerning, including this call for licensing and auditing of AI as if it was the financial services industry or something like that.
If there were to be licensing and auditing of this new technology, are they also proposing some sort of new federal bureaucracy and more of a deep state to deal with it?
Yes, I think the call in the Blumenthal-Hawley bill includes a new organization that would deal with this within the federal government. It would be a new bureaucracy. And they have some very specific asks that would prevent people who actually built things in the industry from being part of this organization. So we would end up with an agency full of bureaucrats who haven't actually built anything, telling the people who are building these systems that they're doing it wrong. And I think that's a recipe for stifling American innovation in an industry where I will say we are the world leader in this technology right now. But if we get regulation wrong in this space, we could very well cede the leadership position to China, for example, And I think we want AI that works the way that on U.S. values, not on Chinese values.
Have we had this type of regulation, Neil, on other software developments that have occurred? We've had rapid development, exponential increases in software and the availability of it in recent decades. Has anything else been regulated in such a manner?
The U.S.'s approach to software development has been very use-based. And so if you use software in certain ways, the use might be regulated. For example, military software, software that's purchased by the military or that is designed by military contractors has to meet the military standards, but we don't have a general regime that says if you're writing code, you need to get permission from the government to even do that for general purpose technologies like artificial intelligence. So this would be a total change in the way that we regulate software, and I think it would wrap a lot of red tape around a bunch of innovation that's happening right now.
You referenced China, and China, of course, is in competition with the United States in a lot of different spaces, including here. Do the Chinese have any such regulation, or are we going to be even more overregulated than China?
Well, China does have regulation around AI, but it's with a very specific purpose of protecting the Chinese Communist Party from misuses of AI. That is a bit of a hindrance on the development of their industry. But what Blumenthal and Hawley are talking about goes way beyond, actually, the types of red tape that China is putting on its industry. And I think it would put us at a competitive disadvantage where we are, as I said before, the world leader in this technology.
Blumenthal and Hawley given any rationale for why they're proposing such a massive increase in federal regulation on an industry such as this?
I think there is, to your point earlier, there is some techno-panic around AI. As I said before, the term is very vague, but there is a lot of discussion about these generative AI tools like ChatGPT that create text or create images from prompts that users give them, where you ask for, you know, a certain type of text or a certain type of image, and the computer can generate that. And it's a very cool technology. It's very powerful. But there's a lot of people who are building on these new and curious tools to say, like, hey, this is some sort of public threat, that these could be AI Terminator-like machines that could harm us. And there's a lot of fear around this. And I think Hawley and Blumenthal are jumping into this space for very different reasons, I would say, and saying, hey, we need government to step in. And so they're taking a very opportunistic approach to what is currently a techno-panic about potential harms in the future that are vague. And they're using that opportunity to say, hey, maybe we need a new government bureaucracy to save us all from the computers.
We have been talking with Neil Chilson, who is a senior research fellow at the Center for Growth and Opportunity. Neil, tell us a little bit about the center. Also, can you give us a website, because you've written extensively on this and other topics?
The Center for Growth and Opportunity, the website is thecgo.org. And the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State, we produce ideas that transform lives. We aim at supporting research and researchers who are exploring the key ways that institutions in society ignite economic growth.
Neil Chilson of the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. Neil, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. It's been a very, very busy week on Capitol Hill. We're going to talk about several aspects of what has taken place. Scott, good to have you back with us.
It's great to be back, Loman.
This week, the process of potentially impeaching President Biden got underway with announcement of an inquiry. Want to tell us a bit about that process, Scott?
Usually the House of Representatives votes to start an impeachment inquiry, but that didn't happen with Nancy Pelosi. It slows things down a little bit. And I think Kevin McCarthy is trying to count the votes there in the House of Representatives, and he's not exactly sure if he's got a full majority to begin the impeachment inquiry. So he went ahead and followed the Pelosi precedent and just launched the inquiry on his own. He appointed three Republican chairmen to preside over the inquiry, including the House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jim Jordan, House Oversight Committee James Comer, and we also have the House Ways and Means Committee Chairman, Jason Smith. And then he laid out a little bit of the evidence that's obviously come through the oversight hearings and the testimony that many witnesses have come before the House of Representatives and given the Republican majority to build the impeachment case. Look, I think that this is a situation where President Biden is going to have impeachment looming and hanging over his head as he fights for his own reelection campaign. It'll be interesting to see whether the House actually does have the votes to move forward, or if this is a sort of a dragged out process where they just continue to drip, drip, drip with evidence, and it ends up being politically damaging to President Biden. Obviously, you don't want a political exercise with impeachment. I think that it needs to restore the House's integrity and basically follow the Constitution when it comes to impeachment. And so that'll be an interesting process unfolding as those House Republicans really educate the American people on what's going on with the president.
Also unfolding this past week, Scott, we have the ongoing process of developing a federal budget, which of course is due by October 1st. We all know that's not going to happen. It hasn't in well over a decade, but there were some efforts to move the process forward this past week. How did they fare?
The House of Representatives, they've been planning on really moving a lot of the security, the national defense, the non-domestic priorities through the House of Representatives. And we know that we've had members like Ana Luna had a baby, Frank Lucas broke his pelvis. You've got Chris Stewart, who's wrapping up his time in the Utah delegation, just given the health concerns with his wife. He announced his retirement a couple months ago, and they're working through that special election. So there's some like kind of a vote issue here, right? And then you add in the House conservatives' concern over the spending levels. You have a real concern that these bills aren't going to result in any sort of a process where legislation is signed into law. And I think House conservatives are very, very worried about an omnibus appropriations bill. Then you have the border security, the Biden border crisis. And many House conservatives want to see H.R. 2, the border security bill, included on an appropriations measure, probably the CR at the end of September. So this week, they couldn't even proceed to the defense appropriations bill. It was effectively pulled from the floor by the majority leader and the speaker. And I think that that was really indicative of the struggle that it is in Washington right now in appropriations and in federal spending and the budgeting to actually pass bills in divided government, especially with a five-seat majority when many members are missing from Congress due to personal situations. I'm really curious to see how this gets resolved over the next couple of weeks. We obviously know that September 30th is the funding deadline, and this shouldn't be a shock to anybody, but Congress just got back this week after, you know, six weeks of a state work period, also known as the August recess, right, and Labor Day. So there was a lot of work that could have been going on during that time, and I don't think that any headway was made toward a resolution that actually ends with President Biden signing a bill at his desk.
This past week, Scott, we had inflation numbers for August come out. Inflation ticked up more than was anticipated, obviously still not under control. Does that give the conservatives in Congress even more leverage to say we've got to rein in government spending, which is helping to fuel this inflation?
Listen, I think it does, right? When we go back to one of the toughest bills that the House Republicans have had to pass this year, I think about the Limit, Save, Grow Act that provided sort of a short-term debt limit increase in exchange for spending restraints and pro-growth policies. You know, right now, as Congress is trying to adjudicate that continuing resolution, and you've got Biden inflation still punishing the middle class, you know, I think at annualized levels, it's still 3.7%, which is much higher than the benchmark that the Fed Reserve wants to hit, around 2%. And so I think that you need to think about these spending reductions. We need to scale it back to 2019, these pre-COVID levels. And nobody really disagrees with the fact that we've pumped $5 trillion of federal spending into the economy. And so I think that that's something that definitely needs to be on the table as Speaker McCarthy ultimately negotiates a plan forward with Chuck Schumer.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, as we typically do, let's end with a few words about the club.
Well, the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. If anybody wants to learn more about the Club for Growth, you can check us out at clubforgrowth.org, and you can actually become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
All right, thank you.
A move is afoot to enact higher tariffs on imported steel, but there is a substantial cost to the consumer for such protectionist policies, as we learn from Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
When you buy an item that comes in a tin can, you probably don't think much about the can itself. You're buying what comes in the can, soup or beans or something like that. But today, let's think about the can for a moment. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. I'm away this week, so instead you're going to get a little preview here of episode 6, actually the last episode of my Reason Magazine podcast series, Why We Can't Have Nice Things. This is an episode looking at some proposed new tariffs on tin cans and what they would mean for American consumers. I hope you enjoy it.
I feel like a goofball running around Capitol Hill telling people about different types of tin plate steel, because I think that there would just be a common assumption, like it's a can, right?
That's Tom Madrecki.
I'm the vice president of supply chain and logistics at the Consumer Brands Association.
American can makers only have a few options when it comes to sourcing tin plate steel in the U.S. There are really just two major players in the market, Cleveland-Cliffs and U.S. Steel. But they don't manufacture all the varieties of tin plate that can makers need, and more importantly, they don't manufacture enough of it.
The most notable thing is that the domestic industry today can only supply 50% of the total market for can making. You simply can't get the quantity or the quality of the steel that's needed by the can making industry from just the domestic industry.
So naturally, the domestic can making industry imports about half of the tin plate steel that it uses each year. Those imports come from all over the world, and Cleveland-Cliffs, in its petition to the Biden administration, started off by asking for new tariffs on nearly all of it, ranging from 13% tariffs on tin plate steel imported from South Korea, all the way up to 300% tariffs on tin plate steel that comes from the Netherlands.
There's no reason to believe that the imposition of these new tariffs is going to lead to anything other than higher profit margins for Cleveland-Cliffs, at the expense of consumers, at the expense of manufacturers, but it has nothing to do with the actual availability of the steel itself.
Instead, taxing imported tinplate steel will have some very predictable consequences.
All of the benefits of these petitions and these tariffs are to Cleveland-Cliffs, their bottom line.
This is Gerard Simica.
I'm co-founder and chairman of Consumer Action for a Strong Economy.
CASE is a consumer advocacy group, so I asked Simica to break down how the proposed tariffs would impact consumers.
Well, higher prices and shortages is really what it comes down to. The foreign tin plate steel is going to be more expensive, and so the can manufacturers and others who use it will obviously have to purchase less of it at the higher price.
Like with pretty much all tariffs, those higher prices get passed down along the supply chain. If you make the raw material, the tin plate steel, more expensive, that means cans become more expensive. That means higher prices for food producers and other industries that purchase cans to pack their products, which means that they in turn have to raise prices when they sell their goods to stores, which then pass the higher prices on to consumers.
The average consumer would see a canned item increase by up to 58 cents per canned item. It's especially painful for lower income Americans who rely on canned foods because of their affordability to put food on the table. It's really going to hurt the people that most depend upon these items, and especially things like your food banks, pantries that rely on donation of canned items.
What I think a lot of people don't know is that the cost of a can is sort of disproportionately weighted towards the most expensive part of that, which is the can, not the food itself. And so when the tariffs go into effect, they raise the cost of steel, they raise the cost of the packaging. You see food prices go up 19 to 30%. That translates to 36 to 58 cents per can.
And no one buys just a single can. Madrecki points out that this really escalates once you think about it over the course of a month.
The average SNAP WIC recipient purchases 7.1 cans per week. So just admittedly, this is back of napkin math. We take 7.1 times 4 times, let's say, 50 cents. That's like $15 less buying power that consumer has. And that starts to be like, well, did they skip a meal? Did they have to put something back out of their cart?
This is the real cost of protectionism. There are concentrated benefits for the businesses and industries that can game the system and diffuse sometimes almost invisible costs for everyone else. An extra 50 cents for a single can of beans doesn't matter that much, but it adds up over the course of weeks and months and across the size of the whole economy. Slowly, in small ways, we all get a little poorer. And then there are the other consequences to think about.
You imperil close to 40,000 food manufacturing and can-making jobs all across the U.S. These are jobs in small-town America connected to agriculture communities, et cetera.
That's an estimated 600 jobs lost for every tinplate steel production job saved. All of this is, in fairness, somewhat speculative, but it's based on what economists know to be true about how tariffs work in the real world. The numbers that Madrecki and Simica are citing here come from a study conducted by the Trade Partnership. That's a nonpartisan trade policy think tank that did this study at the request of the Consumer Brands Association. And if you were responsible for making a decision that could burden consumers with higher costs, potentially destroy or outsource thousands of American jobs, and make our food supply chains less resilient, you'd probably want to know about those potential consequences before you decided anything. But here's the kicker. The U.S. Department of Commerce does not consider any of the things that we've been discussing for the past 10 minutes.
There's nobody that says, wait. Is this good for America? Is this good for the American consumer? Is this good for jobs and food making or can making or anybody else? No. That's, in fact, it's statutorily prohibited to do any of those things.
In the rest of the episode, we talk more about why the Commerce Department doesn't consider these consequences and why, frankly, they should. But we're out of time for today. You can check out the rest of that episode and the rest of the series, Why We Can't Have Nice Things, at Reason.com. Also find it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever else you might get your podcasts. For Reason Magazine, I am Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
It was pure evil that struck America on September 11th, 2001, and that is something we must always remember. So says Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The past week brought us the 22nd anniversary of the 9/11 attacks on America in 2001. We were reminded to remember 9/11 and never forget. But just what is it that we should remember and never forget? Was it the evil of the perpetrators and those behind them? Or was it the heroism of so many who rose up that day, like Todd Beamer on Flight 93, or the firemen who rushed into the inferno of the World Trade Center in the hope of saving lives while freely offering their own? Or both? Were the attacks of 9/11 acts of war? War is inherently binary, one side versus another. Many of the most eloquent comments made just after that fateful day were binary in nature. If the attackers were evil, then the victims were good. But modern political progressivism rejects the notion of evil. And if evil is rejected, then so must be the notion of good. For theists, whether Christian, Jewish, Muslim, or nearly every other form of theism, the eternal and universal struggle of life itself is between good and evil. Good is typically represented by a being or force, variously named God, Yahweh, Allah, Buddha, Eshwara, Krishna, Jesus, Great Spirit, or Tao, among over 100 such names. If any or all of these represent pure good, then it stands to reason that there must be a similar but opposite being or force that is pure evil. Many of the commentators on 9/11 instantly described the attackers and those behind them as pure evil. Yet modern progressives, many of whom are also atheists, have great difficulty even admitting that such a thing as evil exists. The great writer, intellectual, and professor C.S. Lewis was an atheist before he became a Christian, and he said that it was the problem of evil that kept him from accepting the teachings of Christianity and the authority of the Bible. Jesus had no trouble speaking of the devil as the personification of evil, but Lewis and today's progressives do. And when Lewis concluded that the existence of evil was inescapable, he found it only natural to accept the existence of good by believing in God. There's a great dodge that progressives use to avoid speaking directly about good and evil. It's intellectually deceitful, but they use it so freely and we hear it so often that we don't even notice their deceit. That's the word hate. They substitute and criticize the 9/11 attackers for being driven by hate. And they just as easily label as wrong the strong negative reaction of many American patriots to the attacks as simply responding to hate with hate. So on this anniversary of 9/11, let's consider the question of evil, not the question of hate. Hate is not always wrong, despite the smug moral superiority of those on the left who try to substitute the problem of hate for the very real problem of evil. God, whom the Bible tells us is love, clearly hates certain things. Psalm 11 says, "The Lord tests the righteous, but his soul hates the wicked." How should we look on Osama bin Laden and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed? Merely as bad because they were motivated by hate for America and our Western values, largely derived from the Old and New Testaments? Or as evil? Hate can be converted or diminished, but evil is pure by definition and thus incapable of reduction through persuasion or acts of kindness. If the 9/11 perpetrators were truly evil, then we cannot minimize the absolute wrongness of their attacks. So I'll give you a choice. Do you resonate with Vice President Kamala Harris, who claimed a kind of equivalence between the attacks of September 11, 2001 and the riots of January 6, 2021? Or do you resonate with these words of former President George Bush when he said on the 20th anniversary of 9/11, "There was shock at the audacity of evil and gratitude for the heroism and decency that opposed it"? If you agree that the audacity of evil is an apt expression for the motives behind those attacks, then you and I stand with President Bush, not Vice President Harris. There is indeed evil in this world. When we remember 9/11, let us also remember the evil behind it. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WCBM-AM in Baltimore, Maryland, WHTY-AM in West Palm Beach, Florida, along with WYLF-AM in Panyan, New York. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.